Hi there again, I'm Todd Fraser with another ANZIC CTG podcast from the 19th annual CTG meeting from the beautiful Noosa Heads here in Queensland. Joining me on this episode is Carol Hodgson, the Deputy Director of the ANZIC's Research Centre, to chat about the two trials that she's involved with and presenting here at the meeting, Team and Predict. Carol, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks for having me.
So Team is looking at early mobilisation of patients who are receiving mechanical ventilation. What's our current understanding of this approach and what's Team going to add to that?
So that's a great question. Across Australia and New Zealand, we've done point prevalence studies and observational studies, and we've looked at individual site practices even since we've done the observational study. And what we find consistently is that although sites report that they are doing early mobilisation and that they're pro-early mobilisation, that in fact most of our mechanically ventilated patients remain inactive and resting in bed for the duration of the time that they're receiving mechanical ventilation. That's a pretty consistent story, and we haven't seen much of a change in the amount of mobilisation, even though I think everybody's more aware of wanting to do early mobilisation with the intensive care unit. And a couple of reasons for that might be simply the fact that our patients are heavily sedated and mechanically ventilated, even though we would like to think that we're not using such heavy sedation. Yep. But also I think it's very staff and resource intensive, and physios are often, for example, if a physio is off sick, they're not covered. If they have an ADO, that's not covered. And the first thing that would be dropped off a busy list would be perhaps getting somebody out of bed on a ventilator, because it's difficult to do in you need several staff members.
And I guess even when there's a economic, you know, you can demonstrate an economic benefit to the hospital of doing that sort of thing, it still requires funding to get those sort of resources up and going, I would imagine.
So that's a really interesting question, because Dale Needham has certainly done some studies where he's looked at observational data, and he's shown that he can get patients up and moving and then out of the intensive care unit and out of hospital more quickly. Yeah. And he's shown an economic benefit, certainly in observational studies. What we don't know is, because we already provide physiotherapy in Australia, and we, you know, physiotherapy is standard care in intensive care units in Australia. What we don't know is if providing more and earlier and active mobilisation will actually improve the process from what we've already got, which is probably better than standard care across a lot of other countries. So this is a unique study, I think, within Australia and New Zealand. If we use international sites, we're going to have to be careful, because we want their standard care to be similar to our standard care.
So what does early mobilisation mean? I mean, you look at some of the Johns Hopkins videos online and you've got fully ventilated patients walking around, but that can go through to bike riding in bed and weights and all those sorts of things. So what's standard?
So standard care is not much at all while patients are ventilated, as I said. And what we're really hoping is that we can implement a program where if patients are stable enough to sit over the edge of the bed and get out of bed and perform sort of balance and strength and mobilisation exercises like walking on the spot or walking or cycling, that they would do that. But if they're not stable enough to do... if they're not stable enough to get out of bed, then certainly we would do in-bed exercises. And you're quite right. Now we've got cycloergometers and we've got hand weights, and, you know, we would expect the intervention to be delivered at the bedside with the patient in bed, but them moving actively. So the physiological stability of the patient will determine whether they can get in bed, whether they have to perform exercises in bed or out of bed,
So tell us about the study. What does Team do?
Okay, so I think Team is going to be the largest RCT of early mobilisation conducted so far internationally. It's a 750 patient randomised controlled trial. We're going to compare standard care to early mobilisation, and we've come up with an algorithm where we assess the patient's strength and we deliver a dose of exercise that we think is appropriate for that patient's strength level. So for example, if their MRC score is at a certain level, we would think they might be able to stand, and then if they're able to stand, we would expect to be able to deliver an hour of active exercises. Now of course that won't all occur in standing, the patient would be completely exhausted, but we would do as much as we can in standing and then bring them back down into sitting or lying to do the rest of the hour, and and that hour can be spread across, you know, the working day. So it may be that the interventional physiotherapist calls in on the patient twice, does 2 half-hour sessions or 3 20-minute sessions, so it can be broken up just so that the patient tolerates it as best as possible.
So do you must have an understanding of what additional resources will be required to do this at a scale that you're talking about?
Absolutely. So what we've funded is an extra hour of a senior physio and an assistant. So we think that the reason that the patients don't get early mobilisation currently is simply that we don't have the staff and the resources to do it. It may also be about sedation and other factors. I guess we're going to find that out. But we've piloted this across five sites, and we found that just by providing enough funding for the staff to actually perform the intervention, that we did get clear separation between the intervention and the control group. So yes, we think that the hour of funding for two staff members and the assistant's great because they can come in and set up the equipment and get the patient ready and get the bed area all ready, and then the physio will come in and supervise the actual mobilisation of the patient.
And do you randomise this by institution or do you do it by individual patients? So could you have...
It's individual patient randomisation, right, and we'll stratify by site.
Right. Yep. So there could be patients within the one unit who have different arms of the study.
Indeed, indeed. And we're hoping as much as possible that there'll be an interventional physio separate to a standard care physio, because we want to minimise, you know, contamination or, you know, somebody getting very enthusiastic about early mobilisation in the control group.
Yeah. So this sort of leads into PREDICT. So a lot of the outcomes, I would imagine, of TEAM are going to be outcome-based for the patient or patient-centric type measures. Tell us about PREDICT and what that's going to be looking at.
I think you're absolutely right. When I started working in intensive care, I guess my real focus was looking at how the patients were progressing through the intensive care unit, but I would often look at a very debilitated patient at the end of a long ICU stay and I'd wonder how they were going to be in 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 months, and a year. And particularly, there was a group of patients that we were dealing with at the Alfred, the ECMO patients, and they were, you know, so disabled at the end of their intensive care unit stay that we actually first of all did a study on the long-term outcomes of the ECMO cohort. And that really did provide a lot of information to me about, well, gosh, we don't know much about disability, we don't know how well our patients are surviving, and of course all the data was coming out at the same time from the ANZICS core adult patient database saying how well our patients are surviving, and you know, survival rates across Australia and New Zealand are above 90%, which is just brilliant. But it does beg the question, okay, so we're addressing clearly the issue of mortality. What are we doing about morbidity?
Yes.
And so the PREDICT study was our attempt at looking at how we need to follow up patients across Australia and New Zealand. So we initially did a pilot study in the Monash Partners Hospital. So it was funded by the Monash Partners Academic Health Science Centre. And we used five Monash sites, public and private. And we just linked into the hospital databases. And we found patients who'd been admitted to ICU 6 months previously, who'd been ventilated for at least 24 hours. And we found who had survived the hospital stay. And then we got the hospital data from the and the ICU data from the hospital records, the IT department. And we could immediately start telephone follow-up phone calls with these patients. So the survivors got rung literally immediately. As soon as we had ethical approval, we could start calling our patients. Right. And we would just link with the data back from 6 months previously. So it's actually like a rapid fire follow-up of patients who... you know, had been in the intensive care unit 6 months previously, and we piloted how we went. And we learnt a lot along the way with the pilot study. We've learnt a lot about finding the right telephone numbers, and we've learnt a lot about the tools that we want to use. So some of them weren't very helpful, and some of them were brilliant. We really loved the WHODAS, the World Health Organization's Disability Assessment Schedule. We used the 12 level. It's quite quick and easy, and it seems to... We're doing some work looking at the... reliability and the correlation between the WHODAS, which really measures function in terms of participation limitations and stuff, and health-related quality of life. So we're comparing it to the EQ5D. And that's really led on to an NHMRC translational project grant, where what we've said we want to do is look at a larger cohort now, 500 patients. So the first study was 262, so we've nearly doubled that. We'll look at 500 patients, and we'll measure their functional recovery at 6 months. And again, it's not any specific group, it's all comers. We could choose to look at specific groups, but what we're trying to develop here is a telephone follow-up registry where studies or centres could say to us, we want to know the outcome, 6 month outcome or 12 month outcome of our cohort. Could you do that? And we would be, we have a call centre, we have trained assessors, we have tested the tools, We're doing lots of work, systematic reviews and qualitative studies to define what tools we should be using. We've linked in with international collaborations on core outcome measures, and we're looking at what tools we should use and at what time point we should use, and we're trying to develop it across Australia and New Zealand with lots of collaboration and lots of input from clinicians who are interested in this work. And we're really excited. We think we've got quite a lot of interest from not only the NHMRC, but also from the academic health science centres and from the Department of Health. So I think patient-reported outcome measures are becoming more and more important. It's really looking at, you know, the patient's perspective of their survival. Yep. And seeing as how we've done such a brilliant job in making our patients survive, I guess it's about time we looked at how they are surviving, the quality of survival.
Indeed. Yep. So there has obviously been growing interest in patient-related outcome measures. Is there a best way of measuring that? You touched on that a little bit.
So do you mean a best measure or the best way of measuring it?
Best way of measuring.
Okay, so patient-reported outcome measures can be used lots of different ways. They can be used in person if you get your patient back into the hospital. So, for example, it's really easy, I think, with surgeons who want to follow up patients pre-op and post-op, because they can give them a survey to complete in the waiting room and the patients can do a paper version.
Yeah.
Or even an electronic version on an iPad, and they've captured their patients because they come in pre-op for assessment and they will be followed up post-op by the surgeon at some point. So, you know, that's a really easy and simple method, and certainly at Monash University there are lots of groups of patients who are being followed up that way. Then there's the registries, I think, that are using it by telephone, and I think intensive care falls into this because our patients come from far and wide. They often don't come back into the hospital once they're discharged, so they might go, you know, from the intensive care unit, they're discharged to the hospital. From the hospital, they either discharged home or to rehab or to another acute care centre. If they go to another acute care centre, you often lose them anyway. So the follow-up process is really difficult, I think, if you need to get a patient back into the primary centre. Mm-hmm. So if you picture a patient going from a small rural centre, getting very sick, needing to be transferred into a major tertiary ICU, and then being discharged back to their small rural centre, it's unlikely that they would want to come back to the major tertiary ICU to be followed up.
Yep.
So I think in Australia and New Zealand, telephone follow-up is really probably the most feasible method of us covering a large base. And if we want to roll this out, and really we do want to roll this out, you know, I think there's been lots of discussion with ANZIC's core, the adult patient database, that we will build PROMs into it and that we will just have ongoing linkage between what we're doing with the registry, the PREDICT registry, and what they're measuring, which will be expanded as they develop their COMET registry. And I think that that's a really nice synergy that will then, you know, potentially we wouldn't do it in all patients, but we'll be able to pick groups of patients that we can do it with using the ANZICS registry.
So the the ultimate objective here is to be able to better identify certain patient groups who are not going to do as well with the prediction tool?
That's exactly right. So we've got risk prediction models for lots of things, but they're generally for survival.
Mm.
So what about a risk prediction model for disability? What would that look like? And we've piloted this in the five-centre pilot study in our 262 patients, and we actually came up with a really surprising finding, and that is that the strongest predictor from the small study, which needs obviously validating in a larger group, but the strongest predictor of disability was if you had a pre-existing mental health condition, which has been shown in other studies, but also if you were separated or divorced. So not even necessarily living alone. There were plenty of, there were plenty of older patients who were living alone, for example, because their partner had passed away or whatever. But if you were separated or divorced, that was a particular predictor for disability at 6 months after ICU.
Wow.
So there's something about social support and there's something about mental health that really does affect the ability of our patients to recover in a functional way. And I'm sure there will be some ICU factors, but in our smaller pilot study, we didn't find that age or comorbidities or illness severity or length of stay had any impact on functional recovery. And duration of mechanical ventilation was a weaker predictor, but it was a predictor in the multivariable model. Yeah.
So hopefully if we can identify some of these hotspots, we can start to look at interventions to help
Exactly. So there's a couple of things we can do with this information. So the first and perhaps the simplest thing is to identify groups of patients who we think won't recover as well as other patients. So for example, let's choose the group of patients who have a pre-existing mental health issue, and it may be that we need to just simply discharge them with a referral back to, you know, their GP with a highlighted red flag that they're at risk of poor recovery, and that we've identified these patients at risk, and to please consider re-evaluating their management of mental health. And that may be something really simple. So I think linking back with primary care is really important. And then the other point, of course, working in the trials group and within the research centre, of course we want this to inform our research program. So yes, we'll be looking at things that we can do early to intervene. So whether that's, you know, if we think that it's really duration of mechanical ventilation, can we alter the way we ventilate patients? Do we need them more awake? Do we need them more active and mobilising? So of course this feeds all back into the programs of research that we're developing there.
Great. Carol, thanks very much for shedding some light on what you're up to. It's been great talking to you.
Absolute pleasure, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me again on this ANZIC CTG podcast. For more episodes, please check out my blog at www.essentialcriticalcare.com.